You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding, Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 9, given in Stuttgart on February 16, 1921, in the evening. Just as it is necessary, on the one hand, to show people the importance of separating and giving a free form to the spiritual life by discussing the threads of the spiritual life at present, it is also necessary, on the other hand, to bring in all the things that demonstrate how economic life must be established on the basis of a principle of association. Above all else, we must call up in people the certain judgment that the individual human being is not in a position to do anything in economic life that might actually bring something productive into it. In the spiritual life, it is certainly true that in the end the judgments must come out of individual human beings. This is why a free spiritual life for each individual person must come into being. The conditions must be created that allow each individual, according to ability, to come fully into being. In economic life, this would serve no purpose. On the contrary, it would be detrimental, because the economic judgments of an individual have absolutely no value. They can never truly take root in reality. You will see this clearly when you stand on an anthroposophical basis. All that is part of the spiritual life flows out from within the human being. As a human being, you must bring out of yourself everything that you have brought along from birth. Of course, you give all of this its form through exchange with the surrounding world. You gain experience, whether it is external, internal, physical, or spiritual. But the process that you go through must come out of your own individual capabilities. Now, if we want to take part in economic life, we have no more effective guide in our humanity than these individual human capabilities. These individual capabilities generally enrich human life, if a person makes use of them. If someone even merely uses them, the collective life is enriched. In economic life, as such, that is to say, whenever you are dealing with exchange and valuation of commodities, the only thing that emerges out of the human being is his or her needs. An individual person knows nothing about economic life and its necessities except by way of individual needs. One knows that one must eat and drink, that one has one's own individual needs. But these individual needs have meaning only for oneself. Finally, only for one's own self. Everything that someone produces spiritually has significance for everyone. Everything that someone produces spiritually is from the start of social significance. Your needs, and they are why one must, in fact, desire the existence of economic life, have significance only for yourself. Economically, you can know only what you have to do to take care of yourself. This does not, however, produce any sort of social standard, nor any sort of foundation for social judgment. The very thing that should be active in social life is excluded if your only standard is what you need for yourself. This is why a social judgment will never find its basis in the knowledge taken from individual needs. The individual human being has no basis for social judgment. If you conduct business solely as an individual, paying attention only to your own needs, and making use of your own reason and capabilities not to produce something for the collective, as in the case of spiritual life, but rather to satisfy your own needs, then you are working, no matter what the circumstances, as an anti-social being. This is the same reason that all forms of cleverness do not help anything when it comes to economic judgments. Again and again I find that I must put forward the example of the defense of the gold standard during the 19th century. If you read the parliamentary reports and other things, for example, what some of the pragmatists in various countries wrote in defense of the gold standard, you will actually find everywhere a great display of individual mental keenness. Everything that was said was actually extraordinarily clever, you might say. You gain a lot of respect for human capabilities if you go back and read the speeches that were made about the gold standard. But what the cleverest of these people said always culminated in the idea that the gold standard would necessarily bring about free trade the world over. And the reasons they were presented so to solidify this assessment are actually incontrovertible. But precisely the opposite has happened everywhere. Following the move to the gold standard, the need for protective duties and the like has come about everywhere. All over the world, free trade has been limited. And this example demonstrates quite clearly that individual human cleverness is of no help when it comes to economic questions, even when it appears as strongly as it did in the 19th century. We err as individuals when we try to conduct ourselves in economic life on the basis of individual judgments. From this we can see with apodictic certainty the necessity of associations. Only when people in the most disparate branches and elements of life come together in association, only when they fill out and broaden their knowledge beyond what they know about one area by becoming familiar not only with their own needs but also the needs of others with whom they are associated, only then will a collective judgment emerge that can move over into economic affairs and lead us towards social healing. There is absolutely no way around the necessity of associations when you simply point out this most basic circumstance. Furthermore, what will become of the economic life as such under the influence of the threefold social organism? What do we actually have in economic life then? We have three factors. The first is something that comes out of an expertise in the production of one thing or another. We must have experts, no matter whether that expertise is in hauling coal, or in harvesting grain, or in husbanding cattle, or in some other industry altogether. People must be experts at what they do. The second is that within our current economic life, the exchange of goods, of basic staples, must be conducted properly. Trade must be conducted in the right way. The goods must be brought to a place where they are needed. Only there do they really have any value. Otherwise, they are not commodities, but objects. We must make that distinction. Something, even food, can in some locations be just an object and not a commodity. If there is an enormous amount of food of a certain quality somewhere, but the people there do not need it all, then there are only as many commodities as there are needed objects. The rest of them are just things, and they will become commodities only if they are taken to a place where they are needed. Without trade, nothing can become a commodity. This is the second important point. But this second factor is connected with human labor. The transformation of natural and non-natural things from object to commodity occurs through human labor. Labor begins with something that we take from the natural world. Thus, it is always possible to trace something created back to its source as an object. And if you trace something back to that state, then you cannot talk about any sort of economic character in that object itself. The thing becomes economic only once it is brought into exchange. Only by doing this does it become something that has significance within the economy. This, however, is connected to the whole process of separating out and unfolding human labor, with the manner and the time and so forth of human labor. The third factor in economic life is that we recognize needs. Only if the needs of a particular territory are known can production be carried out in a sensible manner. Something that is overproduced will become disproportionately cheap, and something that is underproduced will become disproportionately expensive. The price of something is dependent upon how many people are appointed to the production of a particular item. This is the basic condition of economic life, that the satisfaction of needs, and specifically the free satisfaction of needs, be the starting point. How much should be made available somewhere cannot be determined by statistics, because it is part of a living process and can be determined only by a group of associated people who are personally familiar with the sum of the needs in a particular area, through personal connections with individuals who need one thing or another, and who can work out together how many people are needed for the production of a particular article from a purely human living standpoint, and not on the basis of statistics. So the first thing that you have within an associative life are people who go out into a particular territory, constituted on some sort of economic basis, in order to learn about what people there need, and who then develop the will to direct negotiations about how many people have to undertake production in a particular branch of the economy so that those needs can be satisfied. All of this must be connected with an understanding of the freedom of those needs. The first people to take up the task I have just described cannot be allowed to maintain some sort of perspective on whether one sort of need is justified or not. Rather, there must be a concern, finally, for the objective statement of needs. The responsibility for combating senseless needs, luxurious, harmful needs, lies not in associative economic life, but rather with the influence of the spiritual life. Senseless, harmful needs must be driven out of the world by teachings from the spiritual life that lead to the refinement of desires, of feelings. A free spiritual life will necessarily be in the position to do this. Simply put, movie theaters cannot be forbidden by the police, but people must be informed in such a way that they have no taste for them. This is the one healthy way of fighting harmful influences in social life. In the moment when, for the sake of economics or politics, we start to tax our needs as such, then we no longer have a threefold social organism, but instead a chaotic intermingling of spiritual, economic, and other interests. Threefolding must be taken seriously in the deepest fabric of our society. There is no freedom when one or another group of censors exists, when one thing or another can be forbidden that lies within the realm of human needs. You can still fulminate in the same way against movie theaters if you have a fanatical opinion about them. This does not hinder free social life. But in the moment that you call the police, when you cry out, quote, "This should be forbidden," close quote, in that moment you hamper free spiritual life. This must be firmly grasped, and we may not shrink back from that fact out of a certain radicalism. So, first of all, we are dealing with people who inform themselves about the needs within a particular territory, and then lead negotiations, rather than making laws, about the necessary production there. You see, it is possible to describe the matter somewhat differently, and then it might even be taken as, shall we say, a little more mundane. But finally, you can also say, as a way of illustrating the point, that in associations, one needs objective agents who are interested not only in helping the person for whom they are the agent to sell as much as possible, but who also really ask themselves, quote, "What do people here need?" close quote, and who then know enough about the trade to understand how production should be undertaken so that these needs are met. With that, we have what I would like to call the first branch of the association. The second branch is then made up of the people who tend to the distribution, the ones who are to ship a product once it has been manufactured, who follow the negotiations and ship the product to the place where it is needed. So we find, in effect, experts on consumption, experts on trade, and experts on production. but these come out of a free spiritual life. For it encompasses everything that comes out of the spirit in the form of human capacities for productive life. What I have first named expertise flows through teachings that come out of the spiritual life. You see, in the associations of economic life, representatives of all three limbs of the social organism will be there. But the associations themselves will be limited to the economic limb and will deal only with economic matters, with the consumption, distribution, and production of goods, as well as the resultant determination of price. In the threefold social organism, it is therefore important that there be corporations that are competent simply within the bounds of the appropriate limb. In economic associations, only economic questions are dealt with. But naturally, there are people within the associations who have capacities and competencies for dealing with what comes out of the spiritual and the rights political realms. Thus, it is not a matter of simply setting the three limbs of the social organism beside one another schematically. Rather, there must be administrating bodies, corporations that have competence in particular areas. This is what is important. You will find this presented clearly and in full detail in title Toward Social Renewal. First of all, it is important that the following appeal be made regarding the relationship of capital to spiritual life. That those who have brought together the means of production through their capacities remain at the task for as long as these capacities are present. Making this decree is an important matter for the spiritual life. Then enough right to judgment should be ascribed to such people that they are then able to elect a successor. This also belongs to free spiritual life. And if they cannot or do not want to elect a successor, then the corporation of spiritual life will decide it. You see, everything that is a function of abstract capitalism becomes the work of free spiritual life within economic life. This is how it is in the human organism. The blood is connected with the circulatory system, but it flows into the head and pulses through it. In the actual social organism, it is exactly the same. This is why it is to a certain extent fatal that, particularly abroad, and especially in the northern countries, a very strong tendency has arisen to speak about the, quote, tripartite, close quote, social organism, rather than the threefold social organism. This tripartite social organism naturally calls up a set of terrible misunderstandings. We are dealing with the division of society into limbs, not separate parts. The individual limbs necessarily work within each other. We must call forth a clear understanding of this. And we can hope that the rational bourgeois, as well as the proletarian, will eventually arrive at an understanding of the matter. In 1919, we already saw the beginning of precisely that. Perhaps a beginning has also been made here or there in other places. But the opposition became so active from all sides that we were temporarily unable to stand firm with the few people we had. This is why we have called upon your potent energies, so that a kind of strengthening of our advocacy for the threefold social organism might come about. It is absolutely necessary, I would like to suggest, that a strong push be made on behalf of everything that comes out of anthroposophical spiritual science and the threefold social organism. For in a certain way, we are dealing with matters of short-term survival. We should not give in to any sort of illusions about this. But we must work everywhere with great clarity. For that reason, I have tried again now to give as clear an imagination as possible of the associative life. If you still want to know more about associations, then I will take care of that this evening by answering your various questions. It must absolutely run all throughout our lectures that we strive for clarity, and that we try to call up an understanding for how a lack of clarity in public conditions, in social conditions, has led to the present state of affairs. I would like to give you an example of that. When you are asked questions about this or that nowadays, People come to you with schematized questions. They say, quote, what is the situation with capital, with small businesses, with property, close quote, and so on. Now, when it comes to healthy social relationships, the question of property is dealt with in Title Toward Social Renewal, although apparently it is only touched on in a dependent clause. But everything that otherwise figures into the discussion is rooted in the fact that in our social life, property plays an incredibly confusing role. As the new economic life arose and imprinted upon everything the character of a commodity, including labor, for example, so that everything could suddenly be bought, property also became a commodity. You could buy and sell it. But what is also hidden in this buying and selling of property? If you want to gain insight into this, you have to go back to very primitive relationships, in which the feudal lord had acquired a particular piece of property through conquest or some other means, and then divided it among those who worked it. Those who then gave back a certain quota in goods or some other kind of due, which amounted effectively to the beginnings of rent. But for what reason did these people pay dues to him, the feudal lord, or to the church, the cloister? Why did they pay? Why did it seem reasonable to them that they should turn over such dues? The only thing that made it reasonable was the fact that while they, the small occupants, worked their property in order to plant it and to harvest, every other second best person out there might come and drive them off that land. Being able to work a piece of property called for the protection of that property. Most of the feudal lords had their own armies, which they supported with the dues they were paid. This was for the protection of property. And the rent was not paid for the right to work the land, rather for the protection of the land. The right to work the land came out of necessity, since the lord certainly could not work all of that land himself. It had nothing to do with any sort of relationships. But the property had to be protected, and for that you paid your dues. People paid dues to the cloisters for the same reason. The cloisters also supported their own armies with which they protected property, or they were bound to a place through some sort of agreement that provided for the protection of the land through some other relationship of power. If you are looking for the origins of property rent, you must understand it as dues paid for the protection of property. If we look closely at this original meaning of property rent, we see that it is related to times when very primitive relationships predominated, when sovereign feudal lords or cloisters that obeyed no one dominated in economic relationships. These relationships stopped, first in Western Europe and then later in Central Europe, due to the fact that gradually certain rights that individuals had in certain regions of Germany, they stopped being individual rights later than everywhere else, were conferred instead onto individual princes, which then became a political act rather than an economic one. The rights were conferred. With the conferral of rights, everything that was in place for the protection of property was also conferred to these princes. It then became necessary for the princes to maintain the armies. For that, they naturally had to demand that dues be paid. This led to the gradual development of the system of taxes, now applied so heavily to us. These dues added to the former, but curiously, the former continued to exist. But it lost its meaning, since the people, who were now the landowners, no longer had to pay anything additional for the protection of their property. The territorial prince and the state were there for that. But property rent remained. And with the new economic life, it crossed over, gradually, into the everyday circulation of commodities. Because the connection between property rent and property lost its meaning, property was able to become simply an object to be won. It is absolute nonsense, turned into reality. Something exists with the circulating process of value that at the most basic level has completely lost its meaning, but is nevertheless dealt with every day as though it were a commodity. Such things can be detected everywhere in our economic life. They have come about for some sort of justified reason, These justified reasons have now been replaced by something else, but the old things remain. And thereby some sort of new process has taken hold and installed senselessness into social life. If you simply take economic life as it is, for example, you are a professor of economics and have thereby the task of thinking as little as possible in the manner that I have just described, then you define property rent exactly as it says in the books. Then it figures into life as something just as senseless. So you can see how much we have to do in order to make people understand that we have nonsense, not only in our systems of thought, but also all throughout our economic life. And if somebody sighs at the economic life, it is actually for precisely these underlying reasons. What is important is that we now arrive at a more solid, more unbiased, more comprehensive thinking than the one that can be developed by sitting in contemporary educational institutions. For in the end, what sort of thinking does one develop there now? You develop the kind of thinking that could perhaps be represented mathematically, but it is developed in such a way that it stands far away from all reality. So you develop thinking that can be learned through experimentation, that can be learned systematically. You develop thinking that in the case of people like Poincaré, Mach, and others, has finally become a mere formality, something that they call simply a, quote, recapitulation of external reality, close quote. To put it briefly, you develop absolutely no thinking. And because you do not develop any thinking, you cannot really begin to take up the national economy. Of course, over time, a national economic method has been established. Lujo Brentano wielded it in a particularly clever way. A reader's aside, I'm pronouncing L-U-J-O as Lujo. I might have that wrong. Lujo Brentano. End of reader's aside. On the basis of understandable conditions, a theory has developed that one should not think about how economic life should be, but rather just observe it properly. Now, just imagine how one is supposed to arrive at a science of economic life merely by observing it. It would be like recommending to educators that they simply watch the children. No real activity can ever come out of that. This is why our national economic theorists are so terribly sterile, because they have this method that demands passivity toward external reality. And the opposite side of this shows itself when people really begin to join in economic life. On the one hand, they develop a science that only observes. But then, when the war came to Central Europe, suddenly one was supposed to get involved in economic life to the point of influencing price formation. What was the result? The national economist Terhala has summarized the results of that, and for this furnishes all sorts of supporting documents in his book on title Free or Bound Price Formation. First, things are made in such a way that no one can see that the people who made them had absolutely no idea what the point of them was. Second, foundational theoretical schemas have been laid that have so little to do with reality that their use results in the ruination of that reality. Third, the influencing of price formation brought only harm and not help to individual businesses. And finally, honest craft and business was harmed for the benefit of the profiteers. Think for a moment about what it means that an official national economist working on the basis of national economic investigations must arrive at this judgment of rights, political, national economic activity. They benefited the profiteers at the expense of honest business and craft. We must only feel what this actually means. These things must be said to people as clearly as possible, so that they see how insensible to reality our civilization is. If we do not set about making clear the kinds of things that I just said to you in relation to property rent, then we never will be able to demonstrate to people the necessity of associations. Think, just for a moment, in the most urgent manner, prevalent to associations, and immediately the experience emerges of just how adversely all of the unnatural things that are in economic life affect price formation. Of course, this cannot become evident if we attend to economic life in such a way that various agents go out into the country and create businesses for individual undertakings. In that situation, the connection between production and consumption will never be evident to them. They are not interested in turning their eye, EYE, toward how much should be produced. For them, only one self-evident truth, in quotes, is valid, that their employers be able to produce as much as possible. This interest in maximizing the employer's production must be replaced by the positive knowledge of how many producers are necessary because the need for a particular article is at such a level and must be attended to in such a way that neither too few nor too many people are working on that product in a given area. This kind of fact-based knowledge must replace the interest for the individual business person. This is the important point when it comes to associations. Now, we must demonstrate to people how the economic life demands a unification of the separate limbs of life due to the fact that it has so many absurd elements within it. Aside from property rent, there are many others as well. The nature of the cartel, with all of its rationing of earnings, deposits, distribution, the mergers, the consolidations, where does this actually come from? In Europe, this more often takes the form of the cartel. In America, the form of the trust. It comes from the fact that because of the many absurd elements present in economic life, the individual can no longer produce anything. Think for a moment of how different it is today, where everything demands a large-scale undertaking, from how it was when individual producers existed as small-scale operations in economic life. What question can a person ask currently if he wants to put himself forward as a producer? His only question is, quote, what is the market situation for this article? Will there be a demand for it? Close quote. An article for which there is a demand looks promising. An article for which there is a lack of demand does not. In earlier times, when the number of producers was small, this did not matter as much. Only when there came to be too many did the individual producer fail. But let us assume for a moment that everything is actually directed toward the establishment of large-scale production, whenever it is noticed that a particular article is needed. Let us assume that this actually serves a purpose. By establishing the large-scale production, we annihilate the very thing from which we inferred that the large-scale production was needed. Insofar as everything tends toward large-scale production, we no longer follow the same standards that guided the earlier small-scale producers. This is why the necessity for consolidation arises. And so then we have cartels and trusts and so on. But the leading circles were entirely careless in relation to consumption. Because they did not attend to this, the mergers and incorporations are based solely on the interests of the producers. Consumption is not considered. This is the essence of what is demonstrated, that we will not get anywhere in economic life without associations. Therefore, the one-sided associations of cartels and trusts, which come about solely for the interests of the producers, must be overhauled so that they are instead oriented toward an understanding of consumption and an insight into the needs of a particular territory. This is how the trusts and cartels, in that they are caricatures of what must finally be created, demonstrate how necessary it is to move in a particular direction, in the direction of associations. All that is left to do now is to seek out how these associations should be created. Wherever we go, we must describe things that come out of real life. Only then will we perhaps be able to make it understandable for people how necessary associations are for economic life. And thus the important thing will be that you direct the lectures that you will give toward the clearest concepts possible. The guiding assumption for this must necessarily be that everything put forward entitled Toward Social Renewal is at its core a kind of axiom for modern social life. No one will ever have to prove the truth of the Pythagorean theorem by applying it to every object in existence, but proof of it must be shown in a few individual cases. Similarly, you do not have to prove in every possible instance the insights into social relationships as they are one. Through their content, they are proven in much the same way as the Pythagorean theorem. And all that is left then is to show how these things must be incorporated into life. This must be attended to. And I would like to add that we should consider our activity in such a way that it connects to all that has already occurred. This is why I said yesterday that it is necessary for us to consider our movement as a whole and not to feel embarrassed about presenting to people what we have done or about saying to them that it is out there. It is the case that the following experience happens more and more, and it is actually quite alarming. Whenever I go somewhere and give a lecture, there is always a table full of books at the entrance to each lecture hall. If I do not mention any of the books, this is always seen as very non-materialistic and spiritual. If I mention one of them, then it is purchased, and usually there are not enough of them there. But people just, in a way, non-materialistically, overlook the others. Now, I always regret that there are so many books that you cannot mention all of them in the course of one lecture. But we must also move about in the present with a realistic sense of what can be done. Thus, I recommend to you that you take the opportunity to recommend our Threefold Social Organism newsletter when you can. For we must eventually reach the stage where it is distributed daily. But we will not get to that point if we do not make it more popular than it is now. And do not forget, at the same time, to recommend other publications. Otherwise, they will be sent back in large numbers, not purchased. It does seem strange to say such things in the midst of serious lectures, but if I do not say them, then most of the time they do not get done these days. And we have, after all, come together in order to understand the things that should be done, for we want to make something happen in the near future. The end of Lecture 9.